where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hey everybody, this is Jill Marie Morris from Perspective X. If you've been searching for a variety talk radio show with an edge, then look no further. Join my co-host Stephanie Benetti and I as we get down to discussing the latest hot topics and relevant newsworthy stories. Informative, engaging, and often controversial, Perspective X is a unique blend of insight, opinion, and wit. So tune in and listen every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. on UPRN 107.9 FM New Orleans. It's not just an opinion, it's our perspective. Perspective X.
Hi everybody, this is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
You are listening to UPRN 107.9 New Orleans.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news. But you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Thank you. Cynthia Dallaire, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
I would be happy to, Gia. I am Claudia Dallaire. I currently have 4 books to my credit. 3 books on different aspects of Egyptian magic. Let's see, Egyptian luck spells and rituals, Egyptian revenge spells, and Egyptian prosperity magic. And my first novel, which is a mystery, set in ancient Egypt, entitled The Wrath of Amun. That's enough about me, I guess.
So do you have another one in the works? I'm sure you do, but you know, is it something to talk about yet?
I actually do. My publisher has, I actually flew out and met him out in L.A. He's a wonderful man, and he gave me verbal confirmation that they are publishing book 2. He's working on the contract even as we speak. The second book is titled The Talisman of Tehuti. And we have now named the entire series because they are planning to publish at least book 1, 2, and 3 and very possibly the entire series. So they will be the Ka Mysteries.
The Ka Mysteries, okay. So, have you also released, I know they're released in a book form, but have you also released them in e-books?
The Wrath of Amun and I do believe Egyptian Prosperity Magic are both available in e-book form on Amazon. Don't we love Amazon?
Yes, we do. We do. I have to admit, I've become a huge fan of the Kindle. I bought one for my mother last year. I'll admit, I do it Kindle for PC and Kindle for Android. I don't actually have a Kindle, but I love it because I have a physical disability, and the physical aspect of sitting and holding even a paperback book in a chair is impossible. I have to have a table. So if I got to sit at the table, I may as well look at it on the computer screen where it's nice and big. So,
exactly.
No, just a click of the mouse and I change the page, and it's much easier physically for me. Now, my mother, as an older reader, she loves her Kindle because it's also easy on the eyes. She has we got her a Touch because we got it just before they came out with the new ones last summer. And, in fact, I didn't know they were coming out when new ones were. I might have waited. But anyhow, she loves e-ink. It's really easy on her eyes. She's had cataract surgery and stuff. Mm-hmm. So important feature for her. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to watch how quickly people are adopting this non-physical book format.
Yeah.
Because, you know, most people say, older people, they're not going to want new technology. This is so easy. I mean, it's not like the VCR. I mean, the VCR was, you know, it was designed by somebody with really sadistic tendencies. Because you had these huge books, all these buttons to push, and nothing made any sense. E-books, it's not like that. I mean, even compared to a computer, you know, my 2-year-old granddaughter can operate an e-book. She loves them. She has her own little tab now, you know.
I've thought about getting one, and I know at some point in time I will. The only problem is a lot of the books that I have are either not available yet as e-books, and I was shocked because some of the books that I have in my collection, I can buy a print edition cheaper than I can an e-book edition.
Yeah, that's true, too. And I've discovered, too, a lot, because, you know, if you work with old books at all, some of them are available on your e-book format, but often they're missing the illustrations.
And that's part of what I use.
The illustrations are a part of the book. So I find it frustrating when there's no illustrations with the old book. You're assuming You know, it'd be like getting Audubon's Birds of America and there's no pictures, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, really disappointing, you know. And so I have both formats. I have lots and lots of books, and I go to the library, and then I also have, you know, this fascination with the e-book. And I'll admit, I love it because, you know, in my e-book library, I've got like 2,500 books. I would need so many bookshelves for all that.
I can tell you how many.
Yeah.
I have, personally, over 3,500 books. So I can tell you how many bookshelves you would need.
I've never counted them. I'm, you know, one of three generations that collects cookbooks. So, you know, we've always, you know, all of us have got all these cookbooks. And it's funny because my daughter and my mother both like to raid my books and steal them. Now, I know they're taking them. They know I know that they're taking them, but they pretense of stealing my cookbooks. And we do this back and forth, you know, you know, sort of a game that we play, because we all know if somebody else has got a book we need or want, you know, we'll get it. But, you know, it's kind of neat that I can have a copy of, like, the White House cookbook, which was printed a long time ago. Now, we have a real copy of it, but old books have brittle paper.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something you're going to throw down on your kitchen counter and try to decipher as you try to recreate something that was cooked, you know, 150 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the ebook format I like because I don't have to worry about that brittle paper anymore. You know, and our local library is pretty small. I will admit that. I may have as many books between the ebook format and the actual books. I may have as many as they do. At least in the, if you just consider the nonfiction, because they don't hold a lot. I was kind of disappointed in that part. You know, I was like, okay, we're going to have to do something here. Figure out a way to beef up their little collection. But yeah, you know, there's, you know, for people who are devout readers, you know, this a whole new thing. And I found that as far as being a writer, publishing with Kindle was, I decided it was ready. I could design my cover, and I could publish it.
Yeah.
I actually never submitted it to a traditional publisher simply because, yeah, why?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. I have two young authors that I work with quite a lot. One young man I worked with at the now-defunct Borders, and the other gentleman lives in Minnesota. I've never met him, but I'm helping them along because they're new authors, and they both have potential. They both have a wonderful writing style, and I'd like to see them succeed. The one that I used to work with he sent me his manuscript, his first novel, and I edited it for him. And he decided to go the non-traditional route, and he's going to self-publish. And I'm just thrilled. And that's why he said he wanted to send it to me. He said, I want it professionally edited, but I can't necessarily afford. Some professional editors do charge quite a lot. And he's working on a budget. So we worked out a working arrangement, and because that's what I do as, you know, a part of being an author, I also freelance as a proofreader and copy editor. So I edited his first book for him. It would be professionally edited. Before he uploaded it, he wanted it to be the best it could be, and I'm thrilled because, you know, a lot of people don't do that.
Well, I'll admit, I finished this book. I sat on it for 2 years. People edited it, and I just sat on it for 2 years. I didn't do anything with it. It just hung out there on the hard drive. You know, and it was like, okay, it's done. It's out of my system. And I don't know what kind of a why. I saw something somewhere about publishing on Kindle, and I thought, okay, you may as well jump in, and if it's awful and people, you know, flame you in reviews, at least, you know, find a new hobby. You know, so far, I don't have very many reviews. It's only been out 2 weeks. All the comments I've gotten have been positive. So I'm with that because, you know, as anybody who's, you know, because it was emotionally probably as traumatic as having a child. There's so much of
invested
in it. And you're like, you know, if somebody does come and flame you, it's really going to hurt. It really, really is going to hurt. And I was thinking about this because I've written some not-so-nice book reviews in the past. You know, when the book I thought was just absolutely awful, you know, I'd written them. Okay, I'll confess, I'm not always nice. If I think it's awful, I would say it was awful. And I'm really awful on people who don't bother using at least somewhat correct grammar and punctuation.
Yeah.
That really, really makes me crazy. And ebooks, unfortunately, are plagued with people who don't always bother to edit real well.
Well, part of the problem is a little feel. Spell check will pick it up. No, it won't. If you use the word there, that's my favorite. T-H-E-R-E, T-H-E-I-R, T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. They all are pronounced the same. If you put the wrong word in a sentence, spell check will not pick it up.
Well,
because it's an actual word.
Well, in my word program, it will pick up grammatical errors. If, like, the apostrophe, it's with the apostrophe S or without. Yeah, I know.
Mm-hmm.
It's possessive. There's no apostrophe. But when you're wisdom, you're thinking and typing, maybe you put it in, maybe you won't. Okay.
Exactly.
It will seem to me that I did it wrong. The wrong there, it usually, not always, but usually will catch it. So I'm surprised at the sophistication that they've gotten in spell check now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can remember the first time I tried it. It was way back, you know, in ancient days when it was my Commodore 28. I had a one-page business letter. I hit spell check. 3.5 hours later, I got it back.
Exactly. Yep.
I was like, ooh, never do it again.
It has improved, but there are still things it will not pick up. And that's why, and when people ask me, how do you proofread and edit? And I say to them, I know this is going to sound odd. I'm old school. I freelance for a publisher, and when I proofread for them, it is required you proofread from a hard copy. You do not proofread on a computer. You use an actual paper copy, you take your little red pencil out, and, you know, your Chicago Manual of Style, and you better use the right proofreading, the proofreader's mark, because that's what they're looking for. And when I proof or edit my own work, I work from a hard copy because your eye will pick up things on a page, the written, differently than it does on a computer screen.
That's very true. That's very true. And even switching between formats, like if you save your file to a PDF or something,
mm-hmm.
I noticed that things that I had overlooked. And usually it was going to be a forgotten indent or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your eye would pick it up much quicker. I guess because of the fact that most of us work on our drafts in the word processor, mm-hmm. whichever one we prefer, you get so that you're sort of used to seeing the mistakes, I guess.
Exactly. Well,
and you know that.
Well, because you're writing it, you may not necessarily pick up on the mistake because your brain is moving ahead. You know what's coming up. So you may only actually be reading on the computer every second or third word.
Right.
You're filling in what's there.
You know what you intended to say, and you will over, you know, like one phrase I can remember that got overlooked several times by several people, not just me. It was something like, you know, and they did, and today they were going to do this today.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's a stupid mistake, and anybody who is written knows that you don't really do that. Probably at some point I'd gone in and rephrased it, and I'd left in the extra one, you know, which is easy to do, and easy to overlook.
I've done it many times.
So, you know, it's something that you can encounter that you do as somebody who's writing something. You know, so whatever made you decide to write about ancient Egypt? I know that it's, you know, the common thread among both the novels and the nonfiction books you've written.
Well, I have been researching ancient Egypt. Actually ancient civilizations, but primarily ancient Egypt, for over 15 years now. What brought me to that? Part of it was a spiritual quest. Part of it was I had always been fascinated with mythology, even as a child. But about maybe 20 years ago now, I started on a sort of a personal quest. I had been brought up Catholic, and I had moved away from the church when I was in my early 20s. And in the intervening years, I had really not had any sort of spirituality in my life. And as I got older, I found that I was searching for something. I didn't know what. So I started investigating the major religions. I looked at Catholicism again, and I knew it really wasn't for me. Even though I was raised Catholic and even attended Catholic high school, it just was not for me. I don't like the role that women play in the Catholic religion. They don't have a role, pretty much. So I'm investigating other religions, and none of them really sang to me. I need to, and I think religion should be this. I think if you have a belief, it should be a part of you. It shouldn't be something that you do when it's convenient. When you're in a time of crisis, that's not when you turn to a higher power. You should have that in your life daily. That's my personal belief. So I started investigating Wicca, which, again, wasn't quite what I was looking for. And eventually my search led me to the beliefs of the ancient Egyptians. And this made a lot of sense to me. So that's how I ended up in ancient Egypt.
Well, I think I'm getting back.
Yes.
I think we're back together again. I think we're going to have technology problems tonight. I was like, I don't know
all
if I'm on the air.
All of a sudden, it was dead silence.
Yeah, I was. I don't know if I was talking to myself or the audience. I talked away, gave out all secrets of the universe. So if you missed the meeting alive, folks, stay tuned, and maybe another moment will occur in which I reveal the ultimate meaning of life. Yeah, so Claudia, you were telling us what had fascinated you about ancient Egypt, and you said that you'd just left the Catholic Church, and about 20 years ago you were on a spiritual quest.
Yes, and I looked at other religions, and the traditional religions just, I didn't think were for me. I just didn't feel that connection.
Uh-huh.
And I also looked at Wicca, and again, that wasn't for me. There were things about Wicca that I liked, but there were things about Wicca that I just didn't like. And I turned to mythology, which had always been a big favorite of mine, even when I was a kid. And when I started reading about the ancient Egyptians and their beliefs, this made perfect sense to me. It was like a light bulb went off above my head, and I said, this makes sense. So I now actually practice what the ancient Egyptians practiced 25 or 2,000 years ago. I practice a daily religion. I spend at least an hour a day in devotion to my particular deity, and my feeling is a spirituality or a belief. And again, this is my, should be daily. You shouldn't just be, you know, calling on a god when you have a crisis or in times of stress. You should be thanking the god on a daily basis that you can get up out of bed every day. You have a job, or you have the love of your life, or, you know, so many times I've heard people say to me, you know, why do bad things always happen? You know, I ask, I pray to God, why does this happen to me? God isn't God or the gods or, you know, whoever you want to call this as, isn't just sitting up there waiting for you to say, hi, I need your help. So, you know, when you turn to them just because you have a problem, I just don't get that. That doesn't make sense to me. And I have a friend who's a religious type person. He's actually a rabbi. And he and I have commiserated on this, and he's, you know, he says, I hear the same thing, you know, Rabbi, why do these things happen to me? Well, you know, what kind of an answer can you give this person? You know, every problem. But if you have spirituality on a daily basis, it, you know, your problems, you're still going to have them. You know, this isn't a cure-all, but at least you have the strength to deal with them. I get a lot of strength from my beliefs, and I've been through quite life-changing events in the past year, and having a belief system has really been comforting. I've had some very bleak times this past year, and it's helped me to have this kind of connection. So that's how I got to ancient Egypt.
That makes sense. That makes sense, you know, and why not? You know, and, you know, sometimes, you know, fortunately, nobody's ever decided why did I write the book that I wrote or to ask me that, because I would have to say, oh. I can tell you how I, you know, wrote it, but, you know, why that, you know, just because. Sure. Actually, I call it my first method of pain management. That was written the first few months. That book was actually written in its entirety just a few months after I got hurt. Then, of course, became the long-winded process, editing and putting it together in a coherent form.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. So that took me three times as long as it took me to write it, but that's okay. That was continued pain management, which may sound a little crazy, but sometimes you need something to focus on just to keep your mind off of it.
Yes.
And that's what I used.
And I find a lot of, I don't want to use the word comfort again. I find a great relief when I write. I can sit down at my computer. Now I'm using a computer all the time. I still like to write the longhand. I do that from time to time. But I love to sit down and just, I kind of get into a zone. And the words just, sometimes I literally bleed over each one of them. Sometimes I sit in front of that computer, and the next thing I know, I look over at the clock, and it's 3 hours later, and I've just been writing. And it's wonderful. It's so fabulous to do this.
I've got to ask you a question. What time of day? Time of day is usually your most productive writing time?
Oh, I actually, this sounds odd, but I read a lot of books on writing. So I did what was suggested in a book, and they said, try writing during the day and try writing in the evening and see when you're most productive. So I tried doing both, and I found that during the day, it's a real struggle. For some reason, after 7 o'clock at night, my creativity, I guess, must kick in. So I've learned if I'm going to write, it's best if I do it after 7 o'clock at night. I may be up until three o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because, yep, it's nighttime for me, and I write almost everything, whether it's blog posts, articles, whatever it is I'm writing, it's usually written in a single-digit number, less than six, and it's not going to be in the PM either. You know, it is the middle of the night. I write it all, and you know, I think back, you know, in my younger days when I'd sit around with friends and we'd all drink wine or coffee or whatever we wanted to drink. Best conversations were always in the wee hours of the night. And I can remember a coworker, we were talking about, you know, this particular little phenomena. And I said, you know, why is it that you can't do this stuff at a decent hour? You always got to do it middle of the night so the next day you feel like death warmed over. And he very seriously looked at me and said, that's because when everybody else in the world around you goes to sleep, their thoughts are no longer sending out vibes to interfere with your thoughts so you can have these deep and profound thoughts. Yeah. Now, the guy was kind of a little odd, you know, a little different. But, you know, I thought that
he was onto something, wasn't he?
It sounds logical to me. It's the best explanation for why it happens. Because everybody said, your best conversations are in the middle of the night, your most creative time, you know, whether it's art or writing or whatever I'm doing, I am most creative in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Well, I would find that I would start writing, and, you know, sometimes I would have trouble getting started, even in the evening, but I found for some reason, maybe because it is so much quieter, I would sit in my home office, and even with open, it was still quieter. There were no traffic noises. There was no bustling going on outside. And I could just sit there, and I would put on some nice quiet music. Oh, it was fabulous. Wonderful. And I would just sit there and create. Now, I have found when I do editing and proofreading, it's got to be a left brain, right brain thing. I am much more creative and attuned to the minutia of doing that kind of work during the day.
Yeah.
So I do my editing, proofreading during the day, and I do my writing at night. And it's wonderful. It works out great. I get a lot done.
If I edited my own work in the middle of the night, I would have to insert something or change something major. You know, I'd create a mess is what I'd do. And so don't do that at night. Write something new. Even if it's something that ends up just being filed as sort of a backstory for another section, just do it on something else. Don't get involved in what's already labeled finished, you know?
Yeah. Because what I would do is I would write in the evening, and then I would then go back and read what I wrote. And if I had a typo here or I had, missed a little punctuation, that I would fix. That's right. The editing part. That's fine. But if I looked at that and said, oh, God, I've got a major rewrite, I would say, no, that's for tonight, because then I can get more into it. I can spend that time. During the day, I'm not going to have that creative process going on. So I would just do the nice polishing edit. The rest of it, I would put a little note, and I would say, this needs a rewrite.
Yeah, I always figure I'm bored with that section of the story. It's not going to entertain anybody else either.
Exactly.
If I don't like it, that's my litmus test. If I read it and I'm like... Because I'll admit, I'm working on another novel out of the same group of people. But the thing was, I've been working on it for way longer than I did the first one. But it's boring. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to start over.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like it. Yeah. I don't like where it's going. There were some things in it I liked. Maybe that'll be part of the backstory, and I'll jump in and come at it from a different way. But I don't like the way that reads. And to fix it, I would have to go. It would be easier to start over because I just don't like it. I figure if I don't like it, why would anybody else?
And I've had several people say to me, "Do you start your novel from page one and just write from page one right to the end?" Which some people do. And I have to admit, now that I've actually written, I'm working on book four of my mystery series. Book one is published, obviously, that's The Wrath of Amun. Book two, my publisher has, The Talisman of Tehuti, and I've already written book three, The Savagery of Set. We see a theme here. All the books have the name of an Egyptian deity in them.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a reason for that. We kind of bring in the attributes of that particular god in the book. There's a reason why the god is mentioned in the Savagery of Set. The reason we have him is he's a god of chaos. And in book three, I introduce a recurring character for the first time. He will feature in later books, and he creates a lot of chaos. So I'm trying to keep the theme as well as what the attributes of the god are. So it's a daunting task in some respects. But I'm working on book four, and I realized, looking back over the book, book one was my first novel, The Wrath of Amun. And I had a hard time figuring out where to start the book. So I just started writing. I have a voluminous outline for my book. I have an outline for every book, and it consists of, maybe three sentences about what the book is about. Every character, so to speak, that's going to be in it, And that's about it. This is my outline. So when I start a book, I know what the inciting incident is. I know that there's either going to be a murder, there's going to be a tomb robbery, there's going to be some sort of scandal, there's going to be an international incident, something. But where do we start? So I may not start on page one. With The Wrath of Amun, I started on page one, and I was able to write it pretty much from the beginning to the end. With book two, I started sort of in the middle and worked backwards and forwards. And that was a little difficult. I wasn't as happy doing that. So now I pretty much write my novels starting from the beginning right to the end. I don't always know what the ending is going to be. I let my characters tell.
I have to admit, I've taken classes in how to write and all that, and as far as fiction goes, and I didn't follow any of the rules. I had I don't remember how many now, but there's like five different stories, and they all came together at the end. Well, the only way you can, because they were all interwoven. All the characters were interwoven, and the whole bit.
Sure.
But it was like these multiple perspectives of the event and, the aftermath and the resolution. Well, in order to make it coherent for someone else to read, they had to be woven together. And that was why the editing was so difficult, was because you had to figure out, you're making a patchwork quilt, and if you don't have it put together right, it just looks like chaos. Well, it was the title had chaos. I didn't want the book to be all chaos. So, yeah.
Now, what I love is when you read this book, a book on writing, or you take a course, and they say to you to have one perspective, one point of view character, maybe two. Excuse me? This is a novel, number one. Number two, you can't always stay with one point of view.
No, because one person
never
sees the whole story. Well, and they don't see the whole story.
Correct.
If you're writing a romance, you want to stay with one character. I don't know. I'm not a huge romance fan, and I don't write romances. Never have been interested in writing them. So, maybe then you do. I don't know.
Actually, no, because I'm trying my hand at, and I don't want to call it an adult romance, because it's going to be a little edgier than that. So I would probably have to say it's going to be erotica.
Uh-huh.
And I cannot write it strictly from one point of view. I'm trying to write it from the point of view of both of my main characters, because both of them are bringing something to this interaction. So why do I want to limit myself to what one character is experiencing? That doesn't make sense to me, since both of them are just as important to the story.
Right, that kind of makes sense, I did have some concerns because in the book that I wrote, I had a lot of characters, and I'm like, I don't want to read like a Russian novel. I never could get through one of them, so hopefully, I managed to separate things out where people can keep straight who did what, and hopefully I kept it straight. That's always been my worst fear. Did I make a mistake and swap a character around or something, I went through it several times to make sure, but, it's always possible. Because there were a lot of characters to deal with, and I did have concerns about that, because everybody brought a little bit of something. Some of them were just sort of...
Oh,
props for a scene, you know, you might say, but they existed and they reoccurred and, you know, they did or were obstacles to things and so forth and so forth.
Sure. That's why I keep an outline for my book so that I have my characters and they're all named and I know who they are and what they're doing. Now, as I get into the book, I'm going to have, you know, the background characters, the people who may not even get named. They're just, you know, the servant, the royal cupbearer brought in the wine. You know, they don't necessarily need a formal name. They're a servant. They're only going to walk on and walk off. You know, if this were a play, you're never going to know who they are.
Right.
Their background. However, even in my first novel, I had what I considered a throwaway character. I called him the harbor master. That's his job. He oversees the harbor at Thebes. Okay. By the third book, we have a whole story about this man. So a throwaway character may eventually morph into a character that can be used. And he's got a name, he has a wife, he has two sons. So I'm going to flesh him out a little bit more. And that's fine. But in the first book, he had really very little to do in the book. So why even name him? He was just the harbor master. And that's fine. You know, so that's why I try to keep an outline of the characters that I know are going to appear. And then I can always eventually, if I have to name a character, then I know I'm not using a name over again.
Yeah, well, I have my little cast of characters. And as I described, I go back and I add that information so that if that character recurs, I remember they have red hair or black hair, or they're shorter, they're taller, they're fat.
Exactly.
How old they are, what they like or don't like, whatever it is about them that comes up.
Absolutely.
And that's how I kept them straight.
Exactly. Well, there's something I noticed when you write a series of novels. Some people are very good at aging their characters throughout the series. Some people write a series of novels, and their characters never seem to age. That really bugs me. So when I did the outlines for my book, I made sure that I aged my characters. So that by the time I get to the end of novels, the end of the series, my characters are not still going to be in their 20s. Pay attention. Over 15 years, these people age.
Well, yeah, and toddlers and babies become characters.
Exactly.
You can't have their parents be the same age anymore.
Exactly. And because this does take place in ancient Egypt, and I have a married couple, they're going to have children, and I never had children, so I have a lot of books on, you know, how children develop, at what age they walk, talk. And this is helping me to actually be able to write. I have a child character who's now 3 years old. So he's obviously mobile at 3 years old. He's talking and he's getting ready for the, you know, they're going to have another child, and he's really excited. He's going to have a playmate. You know, you have to be able to have a real interaction with a child, but they're not small adults.
No, so, what I remember from my kids was, that's the age of why, how come.
Uh-huh.
I tell everybody, I'm the perpetual three-year-old. I'm still saying, why? How come? Why do I have to do that? How come?
Exactly. You know, I had to laugh at something you said when you said writing a book is like birthing a child. And when I wrote my first nonfiction book, Egyptian Spells and Rituals. I finished the book, and I edited the book, and I printed it out, and I sat and looked at it, and I said, I now have to send this out, and people are going to read this, and they're either going to love it or they're going to hate it. Am I really ready to do that? Am I really ready to hear people say, we don't want your book? Is it that they don't like the book? They don't like my writing? They don't like me? And I really had to develop a bit of a thick skin, but you do get rejection letters. And are you going to get that rejection letter and say, oh, I'm never going to send this out again. This is my baby. So I really struggled with what to do with my first book. And I finally said, no, I want someone to read this book. And I sent it out and held my breath. But it is. It's like your child.
Yeah, it is. And actually, in a way, it's even more reflective. It sort of reflects your personal self in a different way, because, you know, if your child is ill-behaved or rude or has smelly drawers on or whatever, you know, that's not you, you know. Mm-hmm. When you send this novel out into the world, mm-hmm. and people say mean things about it, there's a tendency to want to take it a little bit more personal.
Absolutely.
I was a little ambiguous about that. I'd had, you know, some people read it, you know, when it was first finished, not polished, but finished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, it's a good story. And I'm like, okay, uh-huh. then it's probably worth finishing the polishing up on it, you know.
Uh-huh. Sure.
It's like you've taken your sculpture and now you're showing it. And what do you think? You know, and uh-huh. somebody says, yeah, you know, I like the shape it's taking. And so then you go and you polish it up and you give it a little bit more flair. And, you know, now it's finished and, you know, you're setting it out there. But you pour your heart and soul into these things, and rejection, if you're not careful, can be really personal.
Oh, yes. And see, I write in two genres. My nonfiction is very personal. I talk about my personal beliefs, my personal practices. And to have someone reject that is like a rejection of me. And that can be very painful. But I've learned, they're not rejecting me. They're rejecting the manuscript. And they're rejecting it. And I know this sounds really odd. I thought it was the first time I heard it. There were good rejection letters and bad rejection letters. And I thought, how can there ever be a good rejection letter? There are. Because a good rejection letter says, the manuscript is not right for us at this time. Could you resubmit it, say, in 6 months? Because they've already got all the books they're going to publish. 6 months from now, they're going to be looking for their next list.
Uh-huh.
That's a good rejection letter. They're not rejecting the book. They just can't use it right now. Okay. Or they might say, we're not the right publisher for this material. And I actually got a rejection letter, very similar. They said, we could not do this book justice, but we do hope you find success with another publisher because it is very well written. Now, that's a good rejection letter. And
yeah.
I said, oh, well, that's wonderful. So then you just, you know, you regroup and you find the right publisher. With fiction, I look at it, with my fiction, I look at it a little bit differently. They're not rejecting me. They're rejecting the story. And it could be they don't like the story. They don't like ancient Egypt. They don't like mystery. They don't like a little romance in their mystery. It could be 101 reasons. But then I just, you know, then I just would resubmit it and find someone who did. And I was very fortunate and found a lovely, small, independent publisher who loves novels based in ancient Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what's not to be happy about?
Right, right. I mean, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely... there's definitely things about all of that that can be really appealing because, you know, the rejection letters that basically say, thanks for your submission, you know, and in between the line there and sincerely yours, whatever, you know, it reads in invisible ink, please don't send us another one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a bad rejection letter. That's saying,
yeah,
you know, either your book wasn't that good or your manuscript wasn't that good. And, you know, and two, for a new novelist that's looking for publishers and may not know who to submit it to, can you recommend a source for them?
Absolutely. I try to connect with as many new authors as I can because my feeling is when it comes to fiction, the major publishers will not even consider you unless you have an agent. And when it comes to fiction, an agent is a great resource in the sense that they know what a major publisher is looking for. And what the agent really is a gatekeeper. They're going to weed out the books that a publisher is not going to want, and they're only going to submit the cream of the crop. That's fabulous. But not is it Stephen King or Tom Clancy. You have authors who've been writing all of their careers. You see their books in every bookstore, and they have a loyal following. Those are the people who find a niche in a small publisher. They may or may not have an agent. I don't have an agent. I don't need an agent to read a contract and tell me if it's a good or a bad contract. I can do this. For my second and third nonfiction books, I negotiated my contract with the publisher. I can do this. You don't need to be an attorney to read a contract and know whether you're getting a good deal or not. So my advice to young authors who are writing fiction is to try small, independent publishers. They spend more time with their authors. They will do more for their authors. And a lot of the small independents offer a much better royalty rate. You may not get an advance, but you're actually going to see a return on your book. And that's so exciting.
Okay, I'm not hearing anything now.
Oh, hello.
Ah, there you are.
Did you lose me again?
Well, this time, I don't think we lost you. I sort of drifted off into limbo somewhere. I was connected, but I wasn't really completely connected. I do think, if I'm not mistaken, that Mercury is still in retrograde. Supposedly that affects communications.
Yeah.
And if tonight's indication of how well it interferes with communications, it's doing a jack job. Yeah. So,
well, I'm in New England, and we're having rain. So that could also be a problem.
Well, the problem this time does not seem to be you because you were still on the air.
Oh, yay!
You were saying I couldn't hear it. They couldn't hear anything I said, but they want to listen to you anyhow, you know. They hear me every week. after that little, you know, hitch in our get along there, so where were we?
Talking about the best thing for new authors to do.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. So did you tell the audience what they should do?
I did.
Good, good, good.
I did.
As I recall, there's a big fat book, Writer's Market, and that's a useful resource as well.
And it is wonderful because it doesn't just list major publishers. It lists small independents. And another thing to do, I know this sounds really odd, type in any search engine the type of book that you have. And you actually might find a very small person who is doing amazing things in publishing who will just love what you've written.
Sounds like an excellent idea, too.
Well, I found my publisher through a friend of mine who also writes books on paganism. His novels were being re-released by Pendrag Publishing, which specializes in pagan fiction. I didn't know there was such a thing.
I guess I didn't know.
So I went to their website and I read their submission guidelines, and rather than say, I heard about you through this other author, I thought I would just submit on my own and see how I did. And I submitted my first novel, and I got a lovely email back from the publisher, and he said, I love your novel. So after I got to know the publisher, I told him how I had heard of him. And I said, you know, I had seen that Raymond Buckland, who I think is just the father of modern paganism, he's written so many wonderful books. I said I had seen that his books were being re-released by you, and I said, and that's why I took a chance and submitted. And then I turned around and wrote a lovely email to Mr. Buckland and said, thank you so much. I told him the success that I was having, and he sent me back a lovely email and said, oh, I'm so happy. So, you know, it could just be, you know, out of the blue that you find your niche.
This is true. One thing I did learn, too, is that despite the convenience of a home printer, it is often, mm-hmm. with a long manuscript, much cheaper to take it to someplace, you know, one of these copy outfits, office stores, and have it printed there rather than printing it at home. Because, you know, even at 10 cents a copy, I think that comes out cheaper than what my ink is, to be honest.
Oh, sure. Well, I don't know if we can, you know, plug any stores, so I will keep them nameless. But there are office superstores, you know, there are several that I can think of, and some awards programs. Believe me, I know. And because I also proofread for a publisher, anytime I get a job, I bring it to them so that they can print it out. I use my rewards card, and the next time I have to print something, I may have a $2 off coupon, or I may have gotten a 20% off coupon in my email. Well, you don't think I'm not going to use this?
Yeah, you know, so, especially since they're all pretty much the same price per page. So if somebody offers you a rewards program and you get a coupon off for your next go-around. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because with a long manuscript, it can easily run you from $30 to $50 to print it.
Absolutely. Well, not only that, but if you're going to be buying ink for your home printer, you want to get rewards points on that, you're going to have to buy paper. You may need to buy different software. Use the rewards program. I used so much in the line of rewards points, I was able to purchase a software, DragonSpeak, which I haven't started using yet, and I really need to. But normally it's $100 in the stores. It was on sale for $50. With all of my rewards points and coupons and discounts that I had, I ended up paying, I think, $22.95 for it.
That's a very good sale.
It is wonderful.
Yes, yes.
So,
yeah, for all those people out there that think if you write a book, you're going to get rich, I got a newsflash
for
you. No, no. Although I have to admit, a lot of the ebook publishers do offer a much more attractive package than is usually offered by a traditional publisher. And that's partly because there is a difference in their expenses in terms of publishing your book.
Correct.
Is what I assume. And it makes sense that the books would be then packaged more attractively authored.
Yes.
I found the idea that, you know, we could do our own cover and I could leave in the full length of the novel and not have to cut out 350 pages or something. Quite attractive, because if I whacked out half the story, I was only going to have half the story. So, that's an advantage.
Well, that's why I advise starting out with a small independent publisher or self-publish. The publisher that I work with on my novel, Pendrag, is fabulous. The editor who worked on my book, he is an absolute doll to work with. He is wonderful. He works for the publisher. His wife does their production work. She does the typesetting. She does a lot of the book covers. So it's a nice little family atmosphere, and they are fabulous to work with. I can pick up the phone and call them. I can shoot them an email. It's not like I don't feel like they're this big conglomerate that I have no one to talk to. These people anytime.
Uh-huh. Yes, you know, because of the kind of show I do work with publishing houses. I work with their publicity departments a lot. You know, I'm sent a lot of books to read. I always have a huge stack of hard copy books. I am starting to get more of them in ebook form than I used to. I think the first one was a paranormal novel from Elizabeth Egan Cox, and that was the first time, my first encounter with an ebook. I'd never, never ever done anything with one before, and I was like, you know what? I think I like this. And it just got worse from there. So, you know, the thing is that I do regard it as, you know, the up-and-coming, I guess, in publishing is going to be the e-format.
Yes.
It saves a lot of trees.
It sure does.
Saves a lot of space on my bookshelves. I might someday have space for a knickknack or two, right? And in terms of shipping, you know, in terms of your shipping alone, you know, it's much quicker. When I get an ebook, you know, the publisher could shoot it to me the same day. I say, yeah, I'm interested. I can see that book or manuscript, you know, within minutes. Whereas with the traditional publishing, I'm waiting days at least and often weeks for it to finally arrive.
Sure.
So if you want, if you want book interviews, it's much, much quicker to send out an ebook.
Sure. Well, having just moved from Arizona to Massachusetts, and having the daunting task of making sure that my personal library of 3,500 books got shipped, trust me, at some point in my life, I will have an e-book, you know, an electronic reader, some form, because I need to find a way to put all of those books in digital format now. I'm not sure them all around all the time.
Well, yeah, having recently moved myself, I had stuff that had been in storage for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and you know, just the amount of damage. Okay, I don't care mm-hmm. how well things are packed. I don't care how good the storage place you have it at
mm-hmm.
is. You know, the clothes smelled funky. I had pots and pans, baking pans especially, that rusted in storage.
Mm-hmm.
Box had never been damaged. It was just humidity, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you know, books smelled funky.
Mm-hmm.
Greg noticed it when he came in after being in the hospital for a week. He's like, this house smells weird. No, it smells like it always does. You just know it now.
Sure.
Because it does have a, you know, an odd odor because we still have things that are airing out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just smell funky after being in storage.
Yes.
And we packed the books well.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but
yeah.
Of course, we're you know, in the process of renovating, so, you know, one room's empty and another room's piled full and boxes mm-hmm. are everywhere and... I'll be glad when that's done. We're in the middle of painting a room. Greg has been forbidden from picking up a paintbrush.
Ah.
So, it's killing him, but I'm like, no, you are not touching it. You know, you were told 2 weeks of nothing. I mean, 2 weeks of nothing. Yeah, he was told he could walk around, he could go to the store with me and walk around a little bit there, too. That was it. Nothing else. No lifting, no nothing. That's what he's getting, along with his diet, which he's not liking either. It's a good thing that the salt, that had already been attacked. So, you know, he was kind of used to the low to no salt. But certain foods that he likes are now on the bad list, you know, like bologna, full-fat cheese, you know, all those kind of things, yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll ever write a book with a character dealing with these dietary restrictions or not, but I'm learning a lot about them.
Well, you never know. You never say never.
Yeah, I mean, you know... Shoot, I could have someday. I could have the main character, the hero of the story, be a cardiac patient, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's all the things that a person does in their life, I think, interferes, or alters, or adjusts, or influences their creative flow as well.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's
mm-hmm.
it's interesting to see, you know, when the story, I can see a lot of the influence from all the years I spent involved in various paranormal things. I can see the influence there, you know. I can see, and I know what sparked this little fragment or that little fragment. It was something somebody said, you know, sometimes 10 years ago or longer even, and you know, it was like. Well, let's you know, put some Miracle-Gro on this and see what happens. I love Miracle-Gro. It makes hair grow. It makes, you know, people get shorter, taller, whatever, yeah. So, Miracle-Gro. I accuse grandnieces and nephews of being fed Miracle-Gro, too, because it's like they're born and suddenly they're ready to start school. I mean, how did this happen?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, their parents should be almost ready to start junior high, and you've got kids when did this happen? And your kids are, you know, almost as old as you are.
Well, I recall a roommate recently had her daughter get married. And I sat there and I said to myself, oh my God, I remember when she was born. And I said, yeah, that was, I think, 25 years ago. Wow, time flies. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, it really, really does. I look at my daughter and we're going to do things and I start treating her like she's a teenager again. And it's like, and in her case, I'll admit, it's probably worse because she's very petite. So being really small stature, she's no bigger than the average 14-year-old anyhow. So easier for me to be my normal, very tactical bulldozer self. You know, she's quite assertive. I mean, she only lets me run over so long, and then she kicks that bulldozer over. I don't have that happen, where she got that tendency from, but, you know, and now my granddaughter is, you know, 2.5, and I'm like, whoa, you know, this happened. You know, I was going to make her a baby dress. Maybe I'll make one for her to start school in, you know. Yeah. That's about how quickly it can come. You know, it's like blink of an eye and boom. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem that long ago when my own daughter was 2.5.
Yeah.
You know, now she's never so much more than 20, to take a line from Peter Pan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's amazing how quickly things change.
Yeah, so then sometimes when you're talking about how characters fail to age in a series of books, now it's explainable when the character has some paranormal aspect that prevents them from aging, but the other people around them are aging. That, you know, that makes sense. But
a
mundane family isn't aging despite the fact that, you know, supposedly years have gone by. You kind of, it's confusing because in real life, like, you know, 1 minute they're a baby, then they're a toddler, and 10 minutes from now they're going to be having a baby. Because life seems to whiz past us all.
So that's why I wanted to stay true to these characters, because they really are a part of my life. When I'm writing, it's almost like they're the ones talking, I'm just taking notes. And to, you know, to keep them the same age is, you know, that's not true to the character. They age. They're going to get older. You know, I may eventually kill off a character. We don't know. But this is all part of life.
Yeah, I mean, in real life we have tragedies. You know.
Exactly. And, you know, even though I love these characters, actually, the third book, The Savagery of Set, was very difficult to write. I don't want to give too much away, but I knew that I was going to have a life and death situation with my main character. And was he going to survive? Now, I knew if he was going to or not, but writing the scene was very difficult, and part of it was because now you're writing the book from the perspective of the other characters, because the main character is unable to do so. So now you have a point of view shift, and, you know, everything is happening now around my main character. So it was difficult to write. It's tough. I don't like to hurt my character.
it's like as a writer you can become a god, because you're creating these beings, you're giving them life, and now you're going to have you sort of fall in love with them. They're part of your family.
Oh, yeah.
And now you're going to have to kill one off?
Uh-huh. It's traumatic. It really is. So they do. They become a part of your life. And, you know, I'm working on book four, and I've kind of taken, I don't want to say I've taken a sabbatical. I literally took almost a year off, and I have absolutely despised the fact that I haven't written in almost a year. But I've had a lot of personal issues this year.
Uh-huh.
So I ended a long-term relationship. We have stayed friends, which is fabulous. It's wonderful. It's working out well. But I've moved cross-country. I'm, of course, looking for work. And having, you know, so many other things that are pressing needs, I've literally shelved the book. And the other day I printed out the book for what I've gotten written, and I read it from start to finish, and I said, oh, I have so much more to read, and now I'm ready to jump right back in. So,
So for you, what is the happiest day? The day you finish it, the day a publisher accepts it, or the day it's published?
The happiest day. You know this is going to sound odd. I think the happiest day is when I start a new novel.
Ah.
Because it's filled with the unknown. It's an adventure. I don't know where it's going to lead. It could be a fun adventure. It could be terrifying. So it's the unknown. I think that's just wonderful. That's my happiest day, is starting a new novel.
Uh-huh, that's interesting. Well, that's at that moment, you're most godlike as an author.
Yes. Yes.
Because you can create anything out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a blank sheet of paper. Now it's a blank, blinking screen, but, you know.
For me, sometimes it's still a blank piece of paper.
Well, another thing we hear about often is writer's block. Is this something that you've had any experience with or known anybody else?
I've had other authors say they've experienced it. I can't really say that I have, because if I get stuck on something, what I do is I know how the brain functions because I was brought up in a medical household. So what I do is I stop writing, because rather than sit there and look green, that's just going to frustrate me. What I do is I take a day or two off, and I do something totally different. I will do cryptograms. I'll do Sudoku puzzles. I will watch television. I will do anything except write or even think about writing. And then after about a day or two, I will sit in front of my computer screen, and I will, you know, turn on the computer, and I will reread the previous chapter, and I usually just start writing.
Uh-huh.
So to say writer's block, I don't know if it exists. It may. I've been very fortunate.
I guess, you know, in my case, when I'm looking at it, I'm like, I'm not in the mood to do this. I do something else. Maybe I'll write a blog post. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll write some stuff up for the website. Maybe I will write a book review. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll go read a book. But I'm just not in the mood to do that, deal with those people right now.
Yeah.
And to me, that's what it's like, deal with those people. That's those people. They're real to me, but they're in my little alternate universe, you know, where everybody knows who I am anyhow.
So does writers, not to me it doesn't, but I've seen other people, even when I was going to school and you'd have this essay and there they'd sit staring at their blank piece of paper. And I'm like, you just start saying something, anything.
Yeah.
You know, anything is better than nothing.
I've heard of authors and well-known authors who have said, you know, they literally could not write a word for 6 months. And I'm thinking to myself, I would rather die. That to me is just incomprehensible. So
because
that's
the way our house is, and trying to yell back and forth, and you literally, the one room is, you cannot hear from the other end of the house. I mean, sound just does not travel in the house. So if one of us is working in one room and the other one is working on a computer in another room, it's much easier to send instant messages than try bellering.
Sure, sure.
Or getting up and having a traipse through the house. And I mean, not to say that we don't, because this house, you know, it's an old house, so it's set up with some real convenient features, like my washing machine's in the kitchen, but the dryer in the workshop at the other end of the house. Out, you have to go out.
Oh, great.
The workshop. You know, I'm so thrilled with the convenience of that. Right? we looked at moving the washing machine, and while it can be done, it wasn't a quick and easy project like it would be in a more modern house, because we don't have PVC switch pipes.
Oh.
We have the really old clay kind. And so you can't just, you know, cut a hole and put in an elbow and offer, you know, a joint, a gizmo thing, and glue another piece in, and away you go. So this isn't going to be a simple little thing.
No.
I'm not sure.
No.
We may have to, in order to move it, it may require replacing all of the sewage line from the house to the road, which is a much bigger expense than replacing 6 feet of it.
Sure.
But, you know, we'll see. It just sort of went on the back tail, live with it, you know. There's no room in the kitchen to put a dryer, period. It isn't going to happen. So even though it's not real convenient, at least I have a washer and dryer in the same house, right? Sort of.
Exactly.
I don't have to run down the street and find a one or something. But, you know, with the sound and everything we do, we type back and forth. And, you know, then, like, when we're working on the website, there's a lot of interactive stuff. You know, he'll write something, and I'll say, I don't like the way that sounds. Let's do it this way. So we added each other's stuff back and forth a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're used to that working relationship. We've been doing it for a long time together. And as far as the novel, this may sound really, really strange, but my husband has never read it. Never read it. Not like he doesn't. I mean, some people, you have a spouse that's not a reader. It's not true for him.
Mm-hmm.
He loves certain genres of fiction. Reads a lot of nonfiction. He reads a lot, but he's never read the book. I razz him about it. Now it's become sort of like a thing, you know, some sort of, you know, silent protest. We're just not going to read it at all now. But, yeah, it gives me to continually aggravate him. You read that book yet? No. Yeah. I know he hasn't, but he has never read it. And I think part of it is he was afraid he'd read it. He'd have to tell me he thought it was awful. I really think he thought it was going to be awful. I know it's not awful. It may not be fantastic literature, which, you know, people seem to like it. That's what it was written for, to, you know, somebody else to read. But I think he was afraid it was going to be really, really awful. So if he didn't read it, he never had to tell me it was awful.
Sure. Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because my former partner, I wrote 3 nonfiction books while I was with him, and I wrote 1 novel. He never read
my three nonfiction books. They were in the house. He could have picked one up at any time. His response was he wasn't interested. The novel came out right as we were splitting up. I presented him with a copy that he read.
Oh. Yeah, well, I fed him with that another twist, yeah. You know, and I can understand why somebody would avoid reading it in order to not have to present a negative verdict.
Mm-hmm.
The not interested comment, though, I think would be kind of hurtful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because it's, you know, you just gave birth to this, you know, baby. And you're not interested? You know, I've labored over this for months. I mean, even with a human baby, it's not months. It might be, you know, hours or...
Yeah. Yep. Oops. Julia, I think I lost you.
Well, I sort of bounced out again. Are you there?
Yes.
I don't know what it is tonight, why I keep bouncing out, but I have. And I have no way of knowing all the usual cues that tell me you're now talking in a void. None of them appeared, you know, because I've got the computer screen in front of me. Tonight it's like, it looks like I'm still where I'm supposed to be. And instead, I suddenly discover that I'm lost in space. Yeah, lost in space. So, yeah, with
entered another dimension.
Yeah, an alternate universe. You know, that's the beauty of fiction. In fiction, you know, you can have interesting things happen in that alternate universe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have trouble with my fiction because when I write about ancient Egypt, I need to make sure that I'm being historically correct, but at the same time, when I'm in the zone, a lot of times I will write something and wonder where that came from.
Yeah, and I've read a book. What's it called? I don't remember right now. But the author actually said on the back of that it was as though the characters told her the story.
Yes.
And it was a historical novel. And it was, I remember it very good, and it's funny, I can't remember the title or the author or anything else about it. But it was a very good story. It held my attention. I mean, I sat down and read it from front to back. It helps that I'm a fast reader because otherwise, you know, if I was a slow reader, I might petrify before I finished it. But no,
mm-hmm.
I do tend to sit down, and when I like a book, I read it literally from beginning to end all in one sitting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I could do it with the one I wrote. It might be too long. I've never tried that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, the whole thing is that most books I do read from beginning to end all in one sitting. And I've often heard writers say that it was as though the characters told them the story. And I would have to admit that in my case, it's like I dream the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, in bits and pieces, but I dream the story.
Well, all of a sudden I will write about, you know, a location in the temple complex. And I don't know if those buildings were there, but they seem real. And, you know, I'm talking about the different sights and the different sounds and the different smells, and I'm like, where is all this coming from? I hope it's historically correct. And then I have to verify if, in fact, they had these animals or these different herbs and spices. And it's like, oh, God, it's terrible sometimes.
Yeah. you know, the, like when you read about all these mummified baboons, I'm like, why would they mummify all these baboons? I mean, really?
I know why. In some cases, the baboons were pets. They mummified their pets. As a matter of fact, in ancient Egypt, when a cat died, the entire family went into mourning. They would shave their eyebrows as a sign of mourning. They just, that was terrible, and they would mummify their cats. They loved their animals. But the baboon was also an animal sacred to the god of writing, Thoth, in Egyptian Tehuti. So if you have a sacred animal, that animal has to be mummified just like a human would. So its spirit can go on to the ice. So that's why they mummified. They mummified baboons. They mummified birds, cats, dogs. They even mummified crocodiles, bulls. Oh, yeah. It was amazing what they mummified.
I can't imagine keeping a crocodile as a pet.
No, well, no, they kept ritual crocodiles. Because they had a crocodile god, Sobek. When the sacred crocodile would die, it had to be mummified.
I guess it didn't wear a crocodile.
I wouldn't have wanted that job.
No, no, not at all.
No. But, oh yes, they mummified all kinds of animals.
And I guess, you know, considering the level of importance our pets have, a red dog is like, you know, my baby. Everybody razzes me about big old red dog. You know, and I know that eventually, in not too distant future, I'll be dealing with her death. Somebody made a joke about me having her stuffed, and I thought that was just horrible. I could not imagine that. That would take a whole new level of morbid creepiness, you know?
Yeah.
I don't even like the trophy heads on the wall. You know, no, I don't even like that. So, no, I'm not going to have her stuffed. She's not going to visit a taxidermist. But I could understand why somebody that was attached to the pet that regarded mummification as a normal part of the grieving and burial process to do that with their pet.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Now, I've known people that had their dogs cremated, had elaborate ceremonies, and paid for them to be in a, whatever they call it, sometimes they have all these niches for all these dog packs and cats.
Just a mausoleum.
Mausoleum, yeah. I kept thinking morgue, and all that wasn't it. Couldn't think of the right word.
Well, I know some people who have had their pets, cremated. All of a sudden the brain stopped functioning.
Right.
And then they keep their ashes because they want to be interred with their pets.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. You know.
Yeah, in our case, when we've had a pet die, we have buried them. Didn't, you know, go through any elaborate process. For one thing, most of my life I've spent in very rural locations. It wasn't like there was a pet crematorium anywhere close.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have even occurred to us. People with rural lifestyles kind of have a slightly different relationship with that, I guess, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Grilkush. I have a cat screaming at me. I have two cats that belong to my housemate. And one of them is very vocal, and she's circling me screaming. I'm not sure what this means.
It probably means something along the lines of, you are totally ignoring me.
Well, that too.
Yeah,
I'm sure it probably means, I want more food. No, it's much too late for food.
Yeah, we have one cat who goes nuts anytime he smells pizza in the house. All he wants is some of the cheese, preferably where it's strung out a little bit. Melted mozzarella cheese. The other one goes nuts when there is pork or ham roasted. But all she wants is the tiniest little sliver.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give her a bigger piece because she won't touch it then. She just wants a tiny little sliver and she's done.
Well, these two, and I don't mean this in a bad way, are garbage scows. They'll eat anything.
No, I have to admit, I'm picky and finicky. They're both rescue cats. Both of them sort of arrived. I'm not a cat person. You know, as people are either dog or cat persons, I'm not a cat person.
Mm-hmm. I am a cat person.
Yeah, I'm a dog person. Dog people tend to be more control freaks, I guess. And cat people tend to be okay with animals that don't obey. And cats are really okay with that, too.
Yeah. Oh, yes, they are.
Not on their vocabulary. So I have... three dogs are spoiled rotten. All three of them are also rescues. But Red has been with me for the longest, and she's my baby. And all 65 pounds of her. But she's getting up there in years. So, you know, I know that not too distant future, especially because she is a large dog, I'm going to be faced with the inevitable end of this particular circle of life with her.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, anytime we've discussed it, and it was like, okay, we live in a sort of marginal neighborhood, and having a good dog or a good big dog is a good idea.
Uh-huh.
Sorts of nonsense. Anyhow, the other two we have are small. And one's a Chihuahua, one's a Feist, and so you know the replacement of Red Dog. This isn't something that I really am comfortable with. I'm getting better with it.
Yeah.
I've been faced with it more. People, you know, encouraging me to think about it. But I'm not as young as I used to be. When I got Red Dog, I was hiking up and down canyons. You know, I was much, much more active. You know, now I don't want a large dog that's going to, you know, exhaust me.
Yep.
You know, I'm not going to go look for a border collie. Even though I know they're great at obedience, anybody who's lived with a border collie knows you give them a job and they're going to make you one.
Believe me, I know my housemate has a collie.
Yeah. So, you know, the things that I would have looked for, like when I got Red, and Red was... I had told some friends I was looking for a bear dog. I had friends and family who were sure that I was going to be eaten by a bear because I did all this solitary hiking and camping. And anybody who's lived in Arizona knows there's huge chunks of the state where there is no cell phone signal, yet having a cell phone, it's just dead weight. Throw it at the bear, you know?
Yep.
Or I was going to break a leg or something was going to happen to me.
Uh-huh.
And anybody who's spent a long time single... You can plan all you want for somebody to go with you, but 9 out of 10 times, everybody is going to back out at the last minute, and you're either stuck with someone home or you go by yourself.
Yep.
So I went by myself. And the compromise was that I would get a dog. So I told everybody, I want a dog. And I'm looking for a big dog, and preferably a female, because I don't like that leg hiking thing. And so anyhow, I get a phone call from a guy I worked with, and he had caught a couple of feral puppies, and asked me to come take a look. I will never... They were 3 or 4 months old. They had never seen humans before. They are not happy. They're in a cardboard box. And he reaches and grabs one, brings out this red puppy, smells to high heaven... Had a black face, and she's really fuzzy, but she's obviously suffering from malnutrition. She's got worms. You can tell by looking at her. And she's snapping and snarling and trying to get anybody and all over. And then he pulls out another one, which was a wolf gray puppy with a black face. And this one was yelping and yowling, but not trying to bite anybody. I said, give me that gray one. That red one's too mean. Well, he told me both these puppies were girls. Well, after this puppy quits peeing all over me, because I did, I ended up with my whole lap getting peed on because they were scared to death. I rolled the puppy over and look at him, and I noticed the him part. And I said, the guy's name happened to be David. And I said, David, you need to go back to school, boy. He says, what you talking about? I said, this isn't a girl. Well, I didn't look. I said, then why did you tell me they were both girls? And my daughter had the mean one. I said, asked her to hold her up so I could see if it was a man or a female. And it was a girl. I said, let's trade. And I'm thinking, because I'd always worked with show dogs, purebred dogs. I'm thinking, I'm not of my ever-loving mind to take this on. This dog is wild, with large hair, and meaner than a rattlesnake. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, sick and wormy and, you know, stinks to high heaven. I said, I'll take her. I said, can you keep her for a couple of days? Let her sort of be around the family and stuff. And he's like, yeah. So he did, and yeah, I brought him the food and stuff for the dog, the puppy.
Yeah.
And I bring her home, and, oh, yeah, she had worms. And I worked 10-hour days on that. What am I going to do with this wild puppy? All I could do with her is eat her. And, of course, worming her had the inevitable results. She smelled even better that night. I had to have a bath.
Oh, yeah.
Scrubbed. You know, and the first 6 months I had her, she was never off leash.
Oh.
I kept her on a six-foot leash. I would figure if she got behind furniture, I was going to lose fingers getting her out. And gradually we came to an agreement. And for years I'd been dealing with a peeping Tom. Never could catch whoever it was, you know, and for years this thing was going on. And one night I'd gotten home kind of late, and I'd had her outside, and I had her tied up inside the fenced yard. And all of a sudden I heard that puppy just going nuts. And I lived in a very rural area, and I thought either feral dogs come into the yard or coyotes were coming up, and either one would wear out and kill a puppy. So I go carrying all over to rescue the puppy. And instead of wild animals, I'm hearing footsteps running down the dirt road away from the house. I have trouble with my peeping Tom.
Yeah.
Again. And things, you know, she's been an excellent companion. I've lived in some really dubious neighborhoods. She's earned her cookies many times over. I mean, she has this neat habit. I would, you know, stop and eat gas when you're traveling alone. I used to drive the Jeep, and I'd just leave the driver's door hanging open, and she would usually stand on the driver's seat watching me put the gas in. And one time, I'm in a Texas town someplace, Texas is where I was that night, and it's late, and this is kind of a dark and spooky neighborhood, and here comes a gang of, you know, that dangerous age group, 16 to early 20s year-old boys.
And oh, yeah.
20s, and there's about six or eight of them, and I thought, oh, no, this is not good. You know, I'm looking at the gas pump. How quick can I get this gas pump to get out of here? Because they were all about a half block away. Well, there goes Red Dog. She hangs out her head, and she has this beautiful Colgate smile. Beautiful grin. She'll make a sound. She grins. And they took one look at that big dog hanging out, and they decided that they saw something real interesting on the other side of the street.
Yep.
I don't know what was there, but it me fine. But, yeah, she's got a beautiful Colgate grin, and she learned to use it. She loves to intimidate people. And if they're on the other side of a chain link fence and they don't jump and act appropriately scared, she gets even louder and more aggressive sounding and grabs the chain link and shakes the fence.
Oh, yes.
That always works. That always works. Only one time we had a guy throwing rocks at her. And I caught it. And I said, you know, I don't know how fast you can run. I said, but this fence here, she can go over in about 3.5 seconds. How fast is it going to take you to get across this and over the other fence before she can catch you?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
He didn't want to throw rocks at the dog anymore because that's about how long it takes. She walks up chain link like it's a ladder. I've never
sure,
seen a dog.
Absolutely. Yep.
She had climbed that fence before to get in the yard after she had escaped on me one time and went missing for several hours. She climbed the fence to get back home and acted like I had abandoned her. But yeah, the connection with our pets, I mean, I'm, you know, a dog for years. I learned a long time ago she was a much better judge of character than I was. If I listened to her about who I dated and who I didn't date, I'd probably had a smoother dating life.
Yeah.
She didn't like, guaranteed there was going to be some sort of issue. Very smart dog.
Well, I have my housemate, like I said, has a collie, beautiful collie. She's 7 years old. She's retired from showing now. She used to be a show dog. And she has two cats that are 5. They're sisters from the same litter. They look nothing alike. They don't even have similar personalities. And for some reason, one of them talks incessantly. And she is, we call her graceful, and we don't mean that at all. She's like a bull in a china shop. The other one is just she's the most graceful creature you've ever seen.
Uh-huh. So, well, you know what has happened to us, Claudia? Despite our late start and everything, we have run out of time.
Oh.
Want to tell everybody real quick where to find your books and whether you got a website.
Absolutely. All of my books are available on Amazon. I do have a website. It is ewitchfreelancing.com. And I am on Facebook. I think everybody is.
Just about, I think. Yeah. Yep. And Claudia has some wonderful posts because I read them every day.
Yay! So,
yeah.
I do all kinds of posts every day.
They're always interesting, always these interesting bits of trivia that things that I never knew before and probably would have never looked up on my own. So it is interesting if you follow Claudia on Facebook. Folks, I hope that tonight everybody found some for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next. We'll bring another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea for your consideration. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. Took a little bacon and we took a little beans. Fought the bloody British in the town of New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. Wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Well, we looked down the river and we seen the British come, and it must have been 100 of them beating on the drum. Stepped so high and they began to sing. We stood beside the cotton bales and didn't say a thing. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming, but there wasn't as many as there was a while ago.
It's definitely fired a force of its own, and I think it originates from off-planet. I don't think it's something that is man-made in the sense that we've created evil. I think we're susceptible to it, and we can become that way, but I don't think it's who we really are. I think we have a blind spot, and evil takes advantage of it.
So, if you were to take a baby, and now this is not possible, of course, but if you could take this child right after it's born and put it on an island where there's nobody else, and